the people. Now, just to put it a little bit into context, we find that at that time, Imam al-Jawad was in a society where the difference between the rich and the poor was increasingly becoming greater and greater. So the people who were wealthy were incredibly wealthy, and then the masses were relatively hands to mouth. You know, they couldn't really make ends meet, and the amount of poverty was quite high in the Muslim society of that time. Now, of course, this is something that is still applicable to the present time. We do have situations where people are barely making their ends meet. Now, here Imam al-Jawad, he gives us this formula, he gives us this key, this remedy, if you will, saying that the honor of a believer is in his unneediness to people. Now, of course, we find that there are some individuals who it is their job to go and ask other people for help, whether it's financial or spiritual or moral or whatever it may be, but they have become accustomed to, they have become habituated. It is normal for them, and matter of fact, they need to go and ask other people for things. It seems like for some reason they are not independent, and they're always consistently asking people for money, even though they might have money, or they're constantly, you know, requesting something from other people, even though they have the means to. It has unfortunately become a habit and a negative attitude for such kind of an individual. And of course, this individual is who acts in this manner is always humiliated and looked down upon. But then again, there are certain situations where it is absolutely necessary to go and ask for help. In these situations, it is not being said that, you know, don't go and ask for help when you absolutely need it. No, you know, you must go and help your other believing brothers and sisters. And matter of fact, helping your believing brother and sister when they are in need is considered to be one of the blessings of Allah. But here, this honor of a believer, of course, the less that you have to go towards others to fulfill your needs, the more honorable you become and the more independent you become. Of course, keeping in mind that we are from beginning to end dependent upon the Almighty Allah. So remember that the honor of a believer is in your unneediness to the people. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Jawad, alayhi salam. And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
From our Imams, the ninth Imam is the first, whose Imamat began at a very young age, about 8 or 9 years old. Basically, look at the special wisdom that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has given to our ninth Imam. What is zinat? Beauty. But let us go to the hadith of the Imam, where Imam talks about a zinat in a very different level. Al-afaf, zinatul faqr. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, you know, people go through different phases in life. People are tested in different ways. And one of the situations that many people would face is poverty, faqr. But even in being poor, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, look for the beauty in poverty. And what is that? Al-afaf. Al-afaf basically can be translated as contentment. Contentment is the beauty for poverty. And if you look at this concept, you will see that, you know, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, even if He restrains the circumstances of a person on a financial, economic level, that is also a way of test and trial for that person. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala would like to see, is there afaf there or not? And what is afaf? It means to live within our own means and not to give in to the desires so that we will be tempted to go and seek the means which are haram. And this is something, you know, praised by the Imam when he says, Al-afaf zinatul faqr. If a person is faqir, he is in need, But he's able to content himself, you know, live within the means of his resources and not do things which are haram, then that is itself a zenith for him.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/en/call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many other great programs as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Egypt's Foreign Minister Sameh Shoukry has met Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in Damascus. In the meeting, the top diplomat conveyed Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi's message of solidarity to Assad and all Syrians affected by the recent earthquakes. He also expressed Cairo's keenness on bolstering historic relations between Syria and Egypt, as well as boosting joint cooperation. Assad, for his part, thanked Egypt for sending humanitarian assistance, asserting that improving bilateral ties among Arab states constitute the foundation for improving the situation in general in the Arab world. Shoukry stressed that Egypt-Syria relations are a basic factor in the security of Arab countries. He also reiterated his country's support for Syria.
Egypt has offered so far 1,500 tons of assistance and will continue to provide all humanitarian assistance needed. Relations between both nations are strong. Egypt supports Syria in facing challenges. We hope Syria overcomes the repercussions of the earthquakes as soon as possible.
Shoukry also held a separate meeting with his Syrian counterpart, in which Faisal al-Maqdad briefed him on the steps taken by the Syrian government for helping Syrians affected by the earthquakes. Al-Maqdad also thanked Egypt for its unwavering aid to Syrians since day one of the earthquakes.
We welcome Egypt's foreign minister, who is visiting his home, people and country. His talks with President Assad focused on the results of the earthquakes and the historic relations between both countries. Egypt played a significant role in assisting Syrians following the earthquakes.
The visit comes a day after a historic trip by several senior lawmakers of Arab parliaments to Damascus, who affirmed they will push their governments for restoring relations with Syria. That's amid an increase in such moves by Arab states. This is the first visit for an Egyptian foreign minister to Syria since the start of the crisis in 2011. It's a clear indication of Egypt's serious intention to gradually restore normal ties with the Arab country. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Tomatoes, one of your five a day. Supermarket giants in the UK are now only allowing three of these and other salad ingredients to their customers. And where there is availability, you'll have to pay a premium, especially when it comes to out-of-season fresh produce. Here is why.
Starting with climate change, 2022 was the second hottest year in Europe. Heat waves and extreme temperatures in Spain, one of Europe's biggest food producers, have meant fewer crops to harvest. The same problem with supplying countries such as Morocco in North Africa. But the UK has its own well-established food industry. One important component of it, greenhouses, many hectares of which now lay barren.
There is a problem, of course, with the high price of gas that is used to heat up these greenhouses. They do require quite a lot of gas input, and that's quite expensive. And the problem is that the supermarkets are also being very tough on pricing. So it's not easy to then raise your prices and get what you want from the supermarkets. And so rather than produce anything at a loss, some producers have obviously decided not to produce at all.
And the UK faces another particular issue. Most of its fruit and veg come from the European Union. The country's exit from the bloc has meant extra costs and bureaucracy added to the strain, especially on the supply of perishable goods.
Brexit has caused a shortage of labour, and a shortage of labour means a shortage of fruit and vegetables at the end of the day. More bureaucracy, and more bureaucracy means more costs, and more costs mean less profits, and therefore lower UK production. It's as simple as that.
The solution, food-producing organizations say, is for the government to provide more support, such as replacing high-carbon fertilizers with low-carbon alternatives, or investing more in soil-free indoor growing techniques, such as vertical farming. Saeed Purza, London.
The first memorial of Martyrs of Resistance Media, entitled Narrators of Resistance, has been held in the Iranian capital, Tehran. The families of media martyrs from Iran, Iraq, Yemen, Syria, Afghanistan, Palestine, and Lebanon attended the event. Addressing the ceremony, the commander of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps Quds Force, Brigadier General Ismail Ghani, praised the Martyrs of Resistance Media as a treasure which must be well invested.
The media presence of our martyrs makes them convey the sublime values that led them to achieve the goal of martyrdom. The global arrogance led by the U.S. promotes that those who own money and the biggest weapons are to emerge victorious in wars. However, despite its limited capabilities, the media of the resistance front succeeded in conveying the voice of truth.
Moreover, speaking at the event, head of the IRIB, Dr. Jebeli, honored the media martyrs on the resistance front.
In hard war, the enemy seeks to destroy our fortifications and force us to retreat from one place to another. But in soft war, the enemy does not use weapons, bombardment, and physically does not seek to push us back from one area to another, but seeks to mislead us, change our thinking, distort reality, and take us away from the straight path. We proudly pay for our resistance, but I would like to say that resistance not only costs nothing, but is a total investment. The participants believe that along with the war launched against the axis of resistance in the military sphere, the U.S. and the Zionist regime have also been using all means in the media sphere to undermine the resistance.
The participants believe that along with the war launched against the axis of resistance in the military sphere, the U.S. and the Zionist regime have also been using all means in the media sphere to undermine the resistance. Journalists of resistance media, as the narrators of resistance and truth, shed light on the realities on the ground in conflict zones, the realities which have been repeatedly ignored by mainstream media outlets of the West, led by the United States. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
Palestinians in Gaza, including resistance factions, non-governmental organizations, academics, as well as civil society groups, held a national conference on Sunday to condemn the Aqaba summit. The meeting between Israeli and the Palestinian Authority officials was held in the Jordanian Red Sea Resort of Aqaba. It was also attended by representatives from the United States and Egypt. The spokesman for Hamas resistance movement said that the Aqaba summit aims to cover up the Israeli regime's ongoing crimes against the Palestinian people.
The Aqaba security summit will only harm the Palestinian cause and aims to abort the simmering uprising in the West Bank and Al-Quds. The participation of the Palestinian Authority in this summit only indicates the resumption of security cooperation with the occupying regime. We call on all countries to hold an international conference to support the rights of the Palestinian people.
The summit comes only days after Israeli regime forces killed around a dozen Palestinians and wounded some 90 others in the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. In its final communique, the conference in Gaza stressed the importance of increasing all forms of resistance against the Israeli occupation and protecting occupied Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque against all Israeli plots.
All forms of resistance against the Israeli occupation all over Palestine are legitimate and will continue to increase despite all conspiracies and challenges. We also warn the Israeli regime against playing with fire and violating the sanctity of Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Palestinians maintain that the Aqaba summit aims to sow seeds of division among Palestinians and to suppress resistance groups in the occupied West Bank.
The Aqaba meeting, which is going to be held today with the sponsorship of the Americans, Egypt, Jordan, and that will include Israel and the Palestinian Authority, is intended, in my opinion, to resume security coordination between the Palestinian Authority and Israel. And also, I think it's intended to crack down on Palestinian resistance.
Many Palestinians believe that the Palestinian Authority has become a haven for small Palestinian factions that have long abandoned the path of resistance against the Israeli occupation. Since the start of this year, over 60 Palestinians, including 13 children, have been killed by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank. Analysts say the Aqaba summit will only give Tel Aviv the green light to kill and maim more Palestinians. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
The current world is facing many environmental troubles like climate change, dust storms, and pollution. In this regard, the Center for Political and International Studies of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of Iran has organized its first national conference on diplomacy and cross-border environmental challenges.
This conference would be a very good turning point for going forward to raise the, let's say, awareness, let's say, global, the national awareness on what is going on, let's say, in terms of climate change impacts, in terms of, let's say, transboundary rivers, in terms of marine pollutions and sand and dust storms. This is the main objective of this session.
The four main issues discussed in the event were diplomacy and climate change, diplomacy and solutions on how to deal with the dust phenomenon, diplomacy and sustainable management of rivers and common water resources, and diplomacy and pollution of the Caspian Sea, Persian Gulf, and Oman Sea.
This conference is considered the biggest environmental event in Iran due to the comprehensiveness of the topics discussed as well as the number of speakers and participants.
The first national conference on diplomacy and transboundary environmental challenges was held in the presence of the Iran Minister of Energy and the head of environmental organization at the Office of the Political and International Studies of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Also, several prominent speakers examined different dimensions of cross-border environmental challenges and presented their proposed solutions for the development of environmental diplomacy in the framework of separate and parallel roundtables. The head of Iran's Department of Environment hailed the efforts made to tackle the country's environmental challenges.
The general approach of the 13th government is that it sees environmental diplomacy as a precursor to political diplomacy. Fortunately, we've seen its results and achievements in the last year and a half. Considering the policies of the government that cooperation with neighboring countries is on the agenda, we saw this cooperation at a very good level, especially with the holding of the regional ministerial meeting of environmental cooperation for a better future in Tehran last year. God willing, the statute of the regional environmental fund is being discussed between the countries of the region, and based on this important achievement, the United Nations thanked Iran in its recent resolution and introduced the Islamic Republic as the host of the international conference on combating sand and dust storms in 2023.
The achievements of the first national conference on diplomacy and cross-border environmental challenges will be useful in the process of decision-making and adopting new policies in the country's environmental sectors. Mahdi Abbasian, Tehran.
An official delegation from the Arab Interparliamentary Union has met with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in Damascus. Assad said the visit shows there are Arab institutions still capable of taking action for the interest of Arab people. He also thanked those countries for their rapid response in assisting Syrians following the earthquake. The head of the union expressed solidarity with the Syrian people, underlining the importance of taking necessary action to ensure Syria's return to playing an active role in the Arab world. The delegation, which includes heads of parliaments of the UAE, Egypt, Libya, Jordan, and Palestine, then headed to the Syrian parliament, where they met with its speaker, Hamoud Sabbagh.
We represent Arab people. This is a historic visit. We wanted to convey a message of support to the brotherly Syrian people. We had a high-level meeting with President Assad, who is a highly educated person. We had a rich dialogue with him. We were glad to meet him. In brief, we came to say that the people we represent support Syria.
Members of the delegation called for the restoration of relations between Syria and the Arab world, promising to exert all efforts for that purpose. They expressed readiness to offer all the help needed to alleviate the people's suffering after the devastating earthquake that hit the country, while calling for all sanctions crippling Syria's economy to be lifted.
The streets of the Yemeni capital were poured with a huge number of Yemeni protesters who came out to express support for Yemen's late president, Saleh al-Sammad. Saleh al-Sammad was assassinated by the Saudi-led coalition back in 2018. He is hailed here as Yemen's martyred president.
We came out today to express solidarity and loyalty to the martyred president who sacrificed his life on the path of Allah. And we say to the killers of al-Sammad, your criminal and reckless atrocities has given new life to a nation. The Yemeni people will accept nothing but the just punishment against the perpetrators.
Protesters also expressed solidarity with Palestinians who are suffering from Israeli regime attacks and crackdowns. Yemen's main cause is the Palestinian cause, according to government officials who addressed the crowd at the rally.
To the Palestinian people, we say, your blood is our blood, and our blood is your blood. Every drop of blood that is spilled in the land of Palestine is a drop of blood being spilled here in Yemen. Any oppression Palestinians face is considered oppression that is happening to us and every honorable Muslim.
The Palestinian cause will always remain dear and deep in the hearts and souls of the Yemeni people.
The latest protest in Sana'a comes in the midst of ongoing political efforts by the UN Special Envoy to Yemen to reach a deal between the Yemeni government and the Saudi-led coalition to end the conflict. Even if the war comes to an end, the Ansarullah-backed Yemeni government will continue to face many challenges from world powers, given its unequivocal support for Palestine.
Despite 8 years of war and a strangling blockade that has stirred Yemen into becoming the world's worst humanitarian crisis, tens of thousands of Yemenis remain defiant and showing support for the Palestinians who remain occupied by the Israeli regime. Yusuf Mawadi, Sana'a.
Stop the war! Stop the war!
Thousands of kilometers away from the front lines of the Russia-Ukraine war, an appeal for peace from
Stop
central
the
London.
War!
But today's protest means that while there may be consensus at the official political level here in Britain and other European countries, anti-war sentiment among ordinary people is on the rise.
Years before the conflict began, anti-war campaigners had warned of the consequences of a NATO expansion to countries that share borders with Russia. Their warnings were ignored.
The calls for it to go on, which is what all the governments are talking about now, is really a call for more of this and for an escalation of the war with the possible threat of nuclear war.
Но нигде.
That threat became more real last week after Russian President Vladimir Putin announced his country was halting its participation in a nuclear arms reduction treaty with the U.S. A response to U.S.-led NATO nations sending tanks and other armaments to Ukraine. Wars come at a cost, and it's not just the Ukrainians and the Russians impacted by this one. The ripple effects of what's happening on the battlefield have already washed up on European shores.
We are seeing an impact on fuel bills. We are seeing an impact on food prices. But I think also there is a growing cynicism that there's no money to pay nurses a decent pay rise. There's no money for the National Health Service, but the British government seems to have endless coffers of money to provide arms for Ukraine.
After a year of war that's seen tens of thousands killed, tens of millions displaced, and entire cities destroyed, will this renewed call for peace make a difference? Saeed Pourreza, London.
At one of Lebanon's local supermarkets, only a few items cost a bundle of Lebanese pounds. The country's cost of living crisis is taking a heavy toll on people, as 80,000 lira equal only $1. As Lebanon enters a third year of a deepening economic crisis, basic necessities like food and medicine have become more expensive than ever before. It has become almost a daily struggle for some families to put food on the table.
The Western sanctions on the one hand and domestic corruption on the other hand have been affecting the situation, and it is the people who are suffering.
Many blame those in power for heeding to U.S. and Western control of monetary activity. People on the street say the increasing rate of the dollar is a major contributor to the crisis.
If the dollar became high, 1,000, the items more and more, not the real price. And you can see this in other supermarkets. You go, one supermarket is cheaper than others. And around 20,000-30,000. Why? So they don't, no control should be controlled, because really nobody can afford many things now in the supermarkets because it's high prices.
God help the families who have children and are in need of basic items like milk and yogurt. Bread has become 10 times more expensive. Even onions are not affordable now. And everything is in dollar.
Currency depreciation and the lifting of subsidies have resulted in a dramatic rise in prices of medicine as well, adding to the problems of a deteriorating Lebanese economy. Lebanon's national currency has lost now more than 90% of its value. Many believe that as long as imports are priced in U.S. dollars, which controls the market, there is very little hope for economic recovery. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. Anti-war protesters have recently gathered outside major American airbase in EU. Demonstrators descended on the Ramstein military installation in Germany, calling for an end to Western arms deliveries to Ukraine. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for the second part, please. Global Times wrote in this regard, after protests in several European countries against the continuous supply of weapons to Ukraine, experts say the divisions within the European Union may also lead to a split within NATO, and the public outcry reflects the strategic misalignment of European countries, making their citizens the biggest victims. According to The Guardian, thousands of people took part in a demonstration recently in central Berlin to protest against giving more weapons to Ukraine, urging the German government to de-escalate the crisis by paving the way for negotiations instead. Police estimated there were 13,000 people at the Brandenburg Gate. Similar demonstrations took place in other German cities as well, The Guardian reported. The protests in Germany were relatively predictable, since Germany is one of the countries most negatively affected by the Ukraine crisis. Zhao Jian, director of the Center for European Think Tank Studies at Shanghai International Studies University, told the Global Times recently, "Europe's interests have not only been harmed by Ukraine crisis, aggravated energy crisis, but also by the implementation of Washington's Inflation Reduction Act, which has pushed Europe into a deeper economic crisis." According to The Guardian, 2 weeks ago, the organizers of the recent demonstration had published a manifest for peace in which they urged German Chancellor Olaf Scholz to stop the escalation of weapons deliveries. It was signed by about 650,000 people, including prominent intellectuals and political figures. The Russia-Ukraine crisis allowed the U.S. to achieve its strategic goal of sowing discord between Russia and Germany. German Chancellor Olaf Scholz said in a recent television interview that he does not see any prospect for peace talks at present. Norbert, a former troop who held a banner reading, "The real enemy sits in the city of London and New York," a reference, he said, to the financial powers, who he claimed were behind the war and had no interest in it ending. Germany, he said, had no right to participate in another war after the Second World War. The Guardian quoted him as saying. According to China's national broadcaster CCTV, hundreds of people demonstrated in Zurich, Switzerland, against the shipment of weapons to Ukraine recently, calling for an end to the implementation of sanctions against Russia. Demonstrators also called on Switzerland to stop moving closer to NATO. The U.S. manipulating its allies and desire to contain Russia have also turned off the European people. Sun Kagan, a research fellow at the China Institute of Contemporary International Relations, told the Global Times, adding, "So, amid the so-called great unity, the rifts within Europe are actually getting deeper." The EU approved a tenth package of sanctions against Russia recently. The package includes tighter export restrictions regarding dual-use goods, as well as measures against entities supporting Russia. Relations between Europe and Russia will be harder to repair after the 10th round of economic sanctions, Zhao said. Once investment flows out of Russia, it is hard for Europe to bring it back. The counterproductive reaction to such sanctions can be very damaging to European countries, he warned. "For European people, defeating Russia is not a realistic goal, but stopping the conflict is the most effective solution. If the European and Russian economies were to decouple as sanctions become more and more expensive, it would deal a devastating blow to the European economy." Kahan International also noted, "People across Europe have marched to protest against the war in Ukraine. Thousands of demonstrators gathered in Brussels and Paris, Berlin and London, to protest against supplying Ukraine with weapons. Thousands of people took part in a demonstration in central Berlin to protest against giving more weapons to Ukraine, urging the German government to de-escalate the crisis by paving the way for negotiations with Vladimir Putin instead. Police estimated there were 13,000 people at the Uprising for Peace at Brandenburg Gate, organized by Sarah Wagenknecht, a renegade member of the Linked Party, and veteran feminist campaigner Alice Schulzer. The organizers claimed as many as 50,000 took part. Similar demonstrations took place in other German cities. In a speech at the protest, she spoke of the start of a citizens' initiative and a starting signal for a new strong peace movement in Germany. She said the demonstrators had been united by the fact that they did not feel represented by the government of Olaf Scholz and his foreign minister, Annalena Baerbock, over their decision to provide Ukraine with weapons. Protesters carried banners reading, "Helmets today, tanks tomorrow, the day after tomorrow, your sons," in reference to the manner in which the coalition government has increased its military support for Kiev, initially donating 5,000 helmets, and more recently agreeing to send German-made Leopard 2 tanks. Other banners in the demonstrations read, "Diplomats instead of grenades, stop the killing, and not my war, not my government. We are like the slaves to war and the warmongers," said Norbert, a former soldier declining to give his surname, who held a banner reading, "The real enemy sits in the city of London and New York," a reference, he said, to the financial powers who he claimed were behind the war and had no interest in it ending. Germany, he said, had no right to participate in another war after the Second World War. In London, protesters chanted anti-war slogans as they held banners against sending more weapons to Ukraine. The group later marched toward Trafalgar Square. Jeremy Corbyn, a former Labour Party leader and Member of Parliament for Islington North, was among the attendees at the anti-war protest. Dalia Sanchez, an anti-war activist, said she just wanted to see the end of the war as so many people have lost their lives regardless of which side they are on. "I don't agree with sending weapons to Ukraine because it extends the war," she said, adding both NATO and Russia should engage in talks to prevent more escalation. John Clark, another participant at the demonstration, also said he thinks NATO's eastern expansion is not right. "I'm here today just because I think we need to stop the warmongers and we need to reconsider what is happening," he added. "I want to see ceasefire and talk for peace," said Clark, adding, "We should be sending diplomats to Ukraine, not weapons." Also in Italy, thousands of Italians also demonstrated across the country in Rome, Florence and Genoa against Western sanctions imposed on Russia and transfer of lethal military hardware to Ukraine. The protesters chanted "No to war and peace," demanding an end to the war and urging the Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni's government stop supplying Kiev with weapons. Anti-war protesters also held demonstrations in Milan, Italy's second largest city, Pisa, Florence, and Lecce, among several other cities. "We represent the majority of public opinion that does not want war but wants peace. We are not only pacifists, we are radically against any war, and the goal we want to achieve is to overcome war as an instrument for regulating conflicts between states," said Maurizio Landini, a socialist in Rome. In Genoa, people took to the streets and chanted "Exit Italy from NATO." calling for Italy's withdrawal from the European Union and NATO. Other slogans, such as "Down the guns, raise the wages," were also shouted. We know well that the problem is another, and it is this system that produces this war. We are workers, students, we are different souls. As the polls also show, there is 60% of Italians who are against sending of arms and against this military adventure, said one protester.
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosrow Shahi.
Shahid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr. He was born in Qadhimiyya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Shahroudi was...
When we look at the works of late Rawzati, we see...
There is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Qamari that he says in Farsi, "Tuhid kalame baraye kalame tuhid."
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. Very welcome to another episode of the program The Teacher, an introduction into the thoughts and works of the most outstanding Muslim Shiite dignitaries and scholars. I am Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Shaykh Rouhani and Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi. Assalamu alaikum, Shaykh Rouhani. Welcome to the show.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
And Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Today we want to talk about one of the most outstanding philosophers, also astronomers, a scientist, a polymath, we can call it an Allama of the 7th century Hijra. He is no one but Khwaja Nasiruddin al-Tusi. Al-Tusi is mostly known for his scientific achievements in the Western world, but today we want to talk about his religious aspect of the life, the achievements that he had, the struggles that he made in order to spread Shiite Islam all across Persia, and also the works that he has produced and compiled regarding Islamic teaching. Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi, let's start with you, brother. Give us some details about the early life of Khwaja Nasiruddin al-Tusi.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, Khwaja Nasiruddin Tusi, his name was Muhammad bin Hassan al-Tusi.
Yes.
He was born in Tus. Tus is known as, in today's world, we say like Khorasan or the city of Mashhad, basically.
Yes.
He was from the northern area of, we can say, like Iran. And later he was buried in Qadhimiyya in
yes.
Iraq because of his travelings due yes. to scholarly life that he had.
And also according to his last will,
yes.
he was buried in Al-Qadhimiyya.
So he was buried there.
Yes.
So he initially got his initial, we can say, like studies like Quran, the Arabic grammar, the ethics and all those. When he was too young, and he also had command over the mathematics as well, which he learned from Kamaluddin Muhammad, one of his teachers.
Yes.
And after that, he started to learn about fiqh, the jurisprudence, and the hadith from his father and his grandfather, because obviously they were also from the scholarly family. So later after that, obviously, he also learned the logic and the, we can say, philosophy
yes.
from different teachers as well. So he was quite a person who had gained or learned different sciences
yes.
at different times, and he had command over them. Therefore, we can see like how he got the presence into the fort of Ismailiyun.
Yes.
You know, Ismailiyun are the group who used to believe in six imams.
Yes.
And they were also known as Shia.
Yes.
So because of his knowledge, because of his family, and because of his way, the way he learned and he became popular, he was popular amongst the, we can say, like kings, different kings
yes.
as well, especially the Shia kings.
Yes.
Either, whichever... school they belong to, but
yes.
he as a scholar was famous amongst them.
Except Timurids and the Mongols who ruled over the Persia at that time. But yes, by the grace of Al-Tusi, they also converted into Islam too. Okay, Sheikh Rouhani, give us some details about the scholarly life of Al-Tusi. As I said at the beginning, it is divided into two parts. One of them, scientific achievements. The other one are related to the knowledge or the ma'rifah that he compiled some books in this field.
Yes, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. You know, Khwaja Nasiruddin Al-Tusi was not only, for example, a jurist. He was also a logician, a philosopher, a theologian, a mathematician, an astronomer. You know, in all these different fields of studies, he had written lots of books and works that are available right now. In philosophy, in theology, in mathematics, his works are really outstanding, really useful and helpful. And even nowadays in the Islamic houses, Islamic seminaries, Shiite seminaries, the students refer to his commentaries on Ibn Sina's works as the textbook.
Yes.
Even still, these books are very much useful and helpful for the students of the Hawza and the Islamic seminaries. But one point that I wanted to mention here about the personality and the very important character of Khwaja Nasiruddin Tusi is this, that unfortunately, some of the Sunni scholars like Ibn Taymiyyah,
yes,
accused him mm-hmm. of supporting the Mongol kings
yes.
in the victory of Baghdad.
Mm-hmm.
When the Mongol king actually conquered Baghdad, actually he killed the Khalifa or the Baghdad Caliph.
Yes.
They accused Khwaja Nasir that he actually ordered the Mongol king uh-huh. to kill him and to kill the other, for example, scholars and ulama. But in reality, when the researchers researched about this issue, they found it that no, before Ibn Taymiyyah, no one accused, let's say, Khwaja Nasir of such
yes.
a thing.
Yes.
It was only Ibn Taymiyyah who did such. Rather, Khwaja Nasir caused the king or the situation that many of the scholars, many of the ulama were saved
yes.
by the help of Khwaja Nasir, by the presence of Khwaja Nasir in Baghdad.
Okay.
Because Khwaja Nasir paid respect to all the scholars,
yes.
either Sunnis or Shias,
yes.
and he tried to convince the king not to
yes.
kill the scholars.
Yes.
He actually protected the scholars, the ulama. So this is a kind of false accusation leveled against him by the Ibn Taymiyyah and some of his students.
And the way
not
of,
true.
And the way of converting, we can say, the Mongols into Islam was very much beautiful through science.
Yeah.
You know, showing them, we can say, astronomy, celestial bodies, you know,
exactly.
and saying that, okay, by looking at the celestial bodies, I can predict about your future, the future of your dynasty. So then they become interested in the religion of Islam, in science.
Yeah,
they also funded very much in order.
Yeah.
And in this way, Khwaja Nasiruddin Tusi saved many scientists
exactly,
who were
yes.
going to be beheaded.
Yeah,
and more importantly, saved many libraries from
yes.
being burned down. We know that the Timurids, you know, and such Mongol kings, wherever they go, the first thing that they did was burning out all the libraries and the books mm-hmm. and the textbooks. And this way, Khwaja Nasiruddin Tusi saved so many precious books and outstanding scriptures in different languages on that time, which were available in the libraries of Persia on that time. Really beautiful. This shows the akhlaq, somehow how interested the Mongols, who were somehow had barbaric behaviors, you know, now are changed into a calm dynasty, interested in science, interested in looking for knowledge. How a scientist can have role in bringing peace into a society.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah.
La ilaha illallah. Okay, beside all these, what about his religious achievements? I mean, his religious compilations, especially on Islam, what are they?
Well, obviously, because he was a theologian,
yes,
and he had entered the Mongols, we can say, like, palace. He has access to the Ismailiyun as well.
Yes.
He had access to different places, we can say, which were controlled by highly official or highly powerful people. Therefore, he had influence over these people. And that's why, you know, the Mongols, which were converted to Shia or Islam, obviously, yes, it was due to him. Therefore, we can see that he had basically, he had been making different libraries.
Yes.
And obviously, there were different places where he had his own influence. On the other hand, obviously, from the books that he had,
yes,
we can talk about different books that he had. For example, Asas al-Iqtibas,
yes,
there was Sharh Isharat wa Tanbihat Bu'ind Sina, there was Akhlaq al-Nasiri, and there is another book, Tajreed al-I'tiqad.
This one is very important.
This is one of the important books, which is on the, we can say, like, it's kind of based on the theology and the philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
It's a merge of both.
Yes.
And about Khaja Nasiruddin Tusi, we should say that he was the first person, according to the historians or,
yes,
the scholars, who brought philosophy into theology.
Mm-hmm.
Because theology is something which is purely used to be based on the arguments and reasons provided from the Quran and Hadith.
Okay.
For example, a scholar, a theologian scholar who wanted to prove something,
yes,
about God, about the, for example, like prophecy, they used to bring evidences from the Quran, the verses,
yes,
and the ahadith of the Prophet.
Mm-hmm.
And their area of reasoning and proving, or the people, that was the Muslim world.
Yes.
Whereas Khaja Nasiruddin Tusi, when he brought like philosophy into it,
yeah,
according to the scholars, he has opened the door for the others as well.
Yes.
That through the intellect, mm-hmm, you can enter the land of Islam, or you can enter the premises of Islam, we can say.
Okay.
So basically, he was one of the great scholars who, in his books, has brought philosophy into the theology. And the proofs that he brought, it was the reasoning, the way he did, it was philosophical reasoning,
yes,
and proofs.
Okay, that's all right. Okay, Sheikh, Akhlaq al-Nasiri is another important work of Khaja Nasiruddin Tusi. What is this book exactly?
Yes, Akhlaq al-Nasiri, from its name, it is known as Akhlaq. It is kind of ethical and moral kind of book in which you will find lots of moral instructions,
mm-hmm,
not only for the individuals, but also for the society, for the politician figures, for the family members, for the parents. For different groups of the people, you may find lots of good and helpful and useful instructions.
Yes.
For example, if we go to the details, it has three, let's say, entries. In the first one, we have a kind of introduction to akhlaq, but based on explaining, first of all, the faculties of the nafs or huwa'i nafs.
Yes.
And based on it, then later, Khaja Nasir tries to tell us what to do with this qua'i nafs, how, mm-hmm, to manage it, how,
yes,
to control it, how to make use of it purposefully and helpfully. And the second entry is, or the second treaty, deals with the family, with how should we live in a family,
yes,
how should we, for example, train the children, how should we treat or behave with the parents, with the children, what kind of relationship should be there between, mm-hmm, them or among the family members.
Okay, very good.
And the third treaty deals with politics.
Mm-hmm.
He actually, you know, this book was written based on the request was made by one of the rulers of that time, whose name was Nasiruddin.
Yes.
Yeah, Nasiruddin Abdul Rahim ibn Abi Mansur.
That's why it's called Akhlaq al-Nasiri.
Yeah, Akhlaq al-Nasiri is
That's
called
right.
because of this,
okay.
that he requested,
yes,
Khaja Nasir to write a kind of moral instructions for him. That's why he wrote that. So he deals with politics as well. Tried to tell him, for example, what kind of society,
mm-hmm,
is the best society according to the Islamic teachings, yeah, and doctrines.
Yes.
And how should, for example, the kings treat the people, mm-hmm. behave the people,
okay.
and how should, for example, the people, what are some of the responsibilities of the people regarding the government and the governors?
Very good.
What are the both sides' responsibilities? And yes, what is the, let's say, best kind of qualities that we can find in a very good, for example, Islamic society,
yes.
in a very good political system?
That's right.
So it shows that Khaja Nasiruddin Tusi was one of the scholars who supported political systems mm-hmm. or politician in Islam.
Yes.
He was of the view that we should have a political system.
Establishment of Islamic governance.
Political figures.
That's right. Okay.
Because he actually, in this, the third maqala or the third treaty of this, let's say, book, he explicitly explains everything about political systems, political manners, political moralities and ethics.
That's all right. Okay, Said Mohsen, anything missed about Khaja Nasir?
Well, about the last book which was mentioned, Akhlaq al-Nasiri, later Khaja Nasiruddin has, wrote a summary of this book
mm-hmm.
with the name of Awsaf al-Ashraf,
mm-hmm.
Which was different from his other books, because in all his books, you can see like he adopted the philosophical methodology
yes.
of explaining the things, whereas this was strictly... we can say Awsaf al-Ashraf written on the basis of an Irfani look.
Mm-hmm.
And there he obviously bring six, we can say, subtitles into the book, six chapters in which he's explaining about the thing. So we highly recommend, obviously, to the brothers, if they can, or the listeners, they can read, they should go for this book. It is a short book,
yes. Yes.
And it's very useful if they want to enter into the, you know, a bit towards the, we can say, spiritual.
Yes.
We can say like...
Wayfaring.
Wayfaring, yes.
Yes, and teachings. That's all right. Really fruitful life. You was just taking a brief look at his life, you know, in this program. We could understand that how much fruitful his life was from the political, socio-political reform that he had. I mean, the role that he had in socio-political, religious reform of the society at that time. And we know that, as I said, leading a dynasty like the Mongols was a difficult task. And through this way, saving so many, we can say, as we said, scientists and libraries all across the Muslim lands. Also, can say, Maraghe Observatory is still working,
yeah,
you know,
of course, yeah.
For looking out celestial bodies. One of the most ancient observatories all across the world was Maraghe, founded by Khaja Nasiruddin Tusi. Zilhijjah 18th, 672, according to the lunar Hijri calendar, is a day that Khaja Nasiruddin Tusi passed away. According to his will and testament, his body was taken into Al-Kadhimiyah, and he is buried just very much close in vicinity of the tombs Imam Al-Jawad and Imam Musa Al-Kazim alayhi salam, in the city of Al-Kadhimiyah by his own will. This shows very much that he belonged to Isnashari, we can say Imamiyah, a school of thought and not a smiley or something else. Thank you, my Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi and Shaykh Rouhani for a nice elaboration regarding the life of Khaja Nasiruddin Tusi. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.ir. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.